along your next slide then, I go from the responding to your question about what would be a debt capacity to laying out some ideas, and this is perhaps the area of the presentation where I'm most nervous, and so the devil gets the best of me when I'm on my computer putting it together the other night. And so I'd say that these are some of my ideas, and they've not been cleared to the third floor, nor do they have the support of the financial community.
Of course, that dragon, does that represent the legislature or the administration?
That's anyway, it's after my... money there for my job.
That's what we do to have money done.
Next slide, please. I've done some work on, again, just part of my job, and I have a lot of energy and pulling up different ideas from time to time. What would happen if we took the stream of revenue from the school tax and earmarked it totally for debt service. Not that it could be used totally for that, but at least in terms of the security. What could you do with it? And I've done some work with the Department of Education and MD on this and developed a financial model with different assumptions and so on. And this is a summary because I was asked to. And he apparently heard about it and asked me to lay it on the table for you all. And so this is how that might work if someone's going to do it. I've assumed the $34 million, less than that in the first year, I think it's $22 million or so, and I think in future years it's projected to be $34 million of revenue. And of course that's unknown because it is a new tax and it's designed to cut down on smoking, especially young people, and if it does, then the tax may be less than the tax. But nevertheless, that comes from our department's forecast of cigarette tax revenues for the school. I secondly assumed that we had the proper legal structure, which is probably not in place now. It would need to be a facilities financing authority. It could possibly be structured through one of your existing agencies, HFC or whatever, although I doubt it. It could be in conjunction with the idea that Mr. Resch thinks I'm going to share with you, have an educational authority of some sort. So let's just say it's the proper authority, and I haven't defined what it is. And we need that for a couple of reasons. First of all, if you want to call these revenue bonds, the revenues have to come in someplace. They can't come into the general fund, or the school fund, I guess, itself could be authorized to be a borrowing bond. Secondly, it would have to have some credibility with the bond council, who would say, yeah, this is not state debt. This is one of the things, structure something that you could do without voter approval if you chose to go in this direction. And then thirdly, it would have to be credible to the financial markets who are going to buy the bond. So those are big assumptions. And then also assume in the 15-year, 5.5% interest rate, and you know from the earlier slides that you could tweak that a little bit, assume the interest rates went a little lower, a little higher, the term was shorter or longer. And I've used 125% debt service coverage, which I think is pretty conservative. Just to define that, for those of you who may not be financial people, the market typically requires in a revenue bond that your revenues don't just equate what the debt service is. They want a little bit of a cushion. I think I referred earlier in a presentation in the HFC, we often do about 103% because the debt service on individual home mortgages and multifamily mortgages is pretty predictable, and if people don't pay, you foreclose and you pay yourself off and so on. So that would be a well-established revenue stream that could fund at 103%. The international airports, I think my requirement there is 108 or 110%. Well, that's anticipate some airline along the line might go out of business, or they have other expenses that they have to cover and so on, so there's a little margin for the bondholders. I've gone on the model I built on this one and said, because this is a brand new concept and cigarette taxes, are unpredictable perhaps,
let's go for 125% debt service coverage. So we basically told the financial model when we're putting it together, don't allow us in any year to finance anything where the debt service would get up any more than, so the coverage would be 125%. So in the early years, it was a lot more than that, and then after year three, I think I did a three-year program, that it would work. My conclusion, having stated those assumptions and my caveats, is that about $275 million of bonds could be sold, if my hunch is right, about these assumptions maybe holding up and the market accepting such a structure. That's not precise. I could tweak it a little bit and be $300 million. I could tone it down a little bit and be $250 million, but I'm coming out in that range in the various runs that I've made on my model. So I just suggest to you, if as part of your deferred maintenance or for any other school-related purposes for construction, you wish to explore revenue bonds, that might be an area to do it from the tax.
Of course. The fair assumption, looking upon that chart, is to conclude that if you went this approach, you basically tie up your tobacco taxes for 15 years to retire the debt of $275 million of school construction.
Correct. However, you would have, you'd actually have a little bit more money because the model, and I can give you those numbers, we're not using everything we receive every year for the revenue. So if you got $34 million in, and if you required $26 million each year for debt service, then you'd have another $10 million each year, assuming your projections held up. But then you wouldn't have it if the revenue came down somewhat. But as long as you could give the bondholder that cushion, I expect in the structure of the financing, maybe with a 1 or 2 year lag time, we could then spend that money for something else. So that would actually make the 275 a little less than it potentially be.
Representative Cavino.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Along your same line, it would seem you don't want to take and put hundreds of millions of dollars into our economy in one shot, in one year. But yet, if you assumed, all right, I have $34.6 million to spend every year, over 10 years, that'll put $340 million into the economy. In fact, over 15 years, it'll put $519 million in the economy. So I guess I'm trying to see in my mind, where is the advantage of bonding when it seems like if we just look at a long-term consistent program, economy-wise, it doesn't create the spikes. We know we can put $35 million bucks a year in school construction now. Why would that not be a better thing to do than to put $275 million on the table at once and then give up part of our buying power because we're paying interest on it?
Sure. Certainly, that advocating program, I was asked to present what could we bond if you wish to do it. And certainly, I agree with the suggestion that you'd never want to do it in one fell swoop. In fact, I'm not sure the market would accept a brand new tax and we fund it. If you were going to bond it, I think and my model was set up on a three-year program. So you'd end up doing $90 to $100 million each year for 3 years. Whether that's a good thing to do or not, I can't say. But I'm saying it might be doable if somebody wished to do it.
The obvious hole in the problem is the fact that we've got a $600 million problem when it comes to schools, and this only gets us half our problem.
I wonder if I could ask a gentleman to make a projection for it and get it back to me. And again, I'm not proposing that we do this, but we're searching for a lot of different proposed solutions here. One proposed solution would be if the public agreed to use the excess permanent fund earnings as debt service or bond issues that the public passed. In other words, not just guarantee, but actually make bond payments from the public with the excess earnings of the permanent fund after inflation boosting and certainly after the dividend debt service. But according to the figures shown here, we will have an excess of $100 million in fiscal year 97. We'll have $139 million. This is, I guess, aggregate. I don't know if it's individually, I think this is aggregate. then it goes to 185 million in 1999, and it goes to 223 million in the year 2000. If the public chose to bond using those surplus earnings, and they passed it in a statewide bond issue, for example, could you tell us, could you project for us how much in the terms of bonds we could use that money for if we're looking at the 15-year bond at 5.5%? Could you get those figures?
Mr. Chair, I certainly could. If somebody provides me those figures, I have computer programs. It's a 2-hour assignment, so I'd be pleased to do that.
They're basically generated from the permanent fund. They provide us with the numbers.
Sure.
That's basically assuming that for the coming year they're going to have $39 million additional in the earnings reserve above its ending balance of $100 million. The permanent fund's projecting they're going to add $39 million, and then another $50 odd million, $45 odd million, and then another. Yeah, they're basically looking at about $50 million for the next few years. Representative Bell.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Forsyth, just when you have the 125% figure for debt service coverage, I mean, I'm wondering if that factors in. I mean, what may or may, does that give you enough coverage if, for example, the federal government passes a dollar to a dollar and a half pack cigarette tax? I mean, I would expect that our revenues would be getting plunging then if the price of a pack of cigarettes not only goes up for 71 cents, the state has done, but then you add an increment to the federal government. Does that give you enough coverage on the 125%?
Through the chair, I don't know. And I'd be pleased to run it at 110% or 150% or 200. That's my starting point, and that's why the introduction to this section, you know, had a guy on a tightrope with the dragon underneath, because any of these could be subject to challenge. And I think to prove that out, you know, we're probably going to have to spend some bucks and, you know, get an outside consultant to really get into it and so on. And it's a whole new idea.
You don't need to run any additional numbers for me.
But on the other hand, I feel comfortable with this based on what I know, which isn't everything, but probably doable. 50-50. Ready for the next slide? So, if I were in charge and told to raise $1 billion, how would I do it? Again, we'll forget for a minute revenue bonds for airports or revenue bonds for cigarette tax, whatever, although that would be required to get to $1 billion. Because it looks to me like if you bought into the $700 to $800 million debt capacity from a few minutes ago, and you did that over 5 years or so at $150 million a year, say for five years, and that included, and it probably would have to be a combination of general obligation bonds that your voters approved, lease purchase transactions that you could do on individual projects that seem necessary, that are real estate oriented, you know, and have a definable territory that could be pledged to the COP holders, and any additional school debt reimbursement bonds that you approve. Then, without identifying capital projects or saying where it should be, deferred maintenance, school corrections, rural sanitation, whatever, it seems to me that you could get at or close to $1 billion with a combination of something like the cigarette tax and then leveraging yourself up to the tune of $700 to $800 million of state supported debt. Again, not advocating, but it's, I would say that's probably doable. Essentially, that represents the comments I had and was asked to address, Chair, unless questions or whatever.
Are there court,
It just takes us a while to get to it.
Well, you can tell you're remarkable.
Late at night, it's like to do it.
You're under the spotlight.
Woodward Library, you want to use business.
Are there any questions?
R.97, good.
Are there any questions for Forrest? Forrest, the issue, you pretty clearly stated that making your calculations for our bond, ratings and bond considerations, you haven't calculated the CBR or the permanent fund, correct? It's just general fund?
Mr. Chair, the revenue forecast that I use has the interest income from the CBR
that
coming to the general fund. So to that extent, that's a small portion of the $2.5 billion. It's like $100 million a year.
That's about $250 million.
Is it that much? Yeah. Well, I was working with last year's projection, maybe the latest one would be good. But it certainly has nothing from the permanent fund. With the exception, I think the general fund may get some reimbursement for some of the expenses of the dividend program. I kind of recall there's a modest amount that comes into the Department of Revenue's dividend paying people. There's a group of people that get the checks out, if you will, or the direct deposits made. So there may be a very, very small amount that comes from the permanent fund. But effectively, no, sir, it does not include any permanent fund and only the interest income from it. Constitution budget reserve. It certainly doesn't use any portion of the principal directly or indirectly.
Okay. Representative James?
Well, I guess, thank you. I was very interested in your presentation, and I guess that I just want to ask you, providing we get something on the table that has more details in it, are you going to be prepared to give us all the intricate answers that we need for how this is going to affect us? And how many, you said that the computer program would be 2 hours, if you have any idea how many hours you'll have to spend to give us those specific answers, and are you willing?
Well, the caveat is, how much of your answers will be dictated by what the third floor thinks of our plan?
I'm always pleased to respond as best we can to any kind of question without advocating policy. So,
That's my question.
Secondly, in terms of the time commitment, we operate with one person. Somebody referred to me and my staff. You see, is my staff within me, and I recently took on the staffing of the bond bank. So I'm pretty busy right now, but on the other hand, things that are important to us, we get done. And so we would hope to be responsive to your group and to our boss and the communities and the bond bank, and at some point if it got completely onerous, we may come into your next budget hearing and ask for the first round, but I don't anticipate that.
Yes, sir, Kelly.
I have a concern about the projections on the tobacco tax, using the revenue from that for school bond construction. It seems to me that haven't we already rolled the revenues from the new tobacco tax into the five-year plan, is that already accounted for and spent?
Yes. Well, yes and no.
It is calculated, new revenues are calculated into our spending plan.
So, basically, I guess what I'm saying is if that's the case, then we can't even go any further on that because we're already spending that money just to get to the five-year plan.
Well, I would think that we're going to lose two votes out of the chute if we do, that being Senator Pearson, Representative Hanley.
If I might respond to that.
Representative James?
This whole projection of the five-year plan is based on general fund revenue. the new tobacco tax is not a general fund revenue.
It is now. I think it is now. I think that's how we're planning.
How did it get there from here?
Mike, I'm right out of Mike.
It hasn't been challenged in court as far as I know.
Well, I guess, Jeanette, I mean, Mike, if you'd care to join us, but the issue comes back around to the consideration of the tobacco tax and our ability or inability to leverage it. And Senator Kelly posed it as, is the tobacco tax currently being calculated into our five-year plan? And my understanding, as I look at this and after talking with Representative Hanley, that it was in fact calculated into our five-year plan. Is that yours?
Mr. Chairman, I first of all say I didn't draft the five-year plan, and I'm not, you know, intimately familiar with it. And I've got a copy here. I'm just trying to look at it and see if it has a footnote or something that explains that.
If while he's looking it up, I could respond. Certainly there be an offset amount from the tobacco tax as a dedicated fund that can only be used for school construction or maintenance or bonding or even insurance on construction. There'd be an offset amount because every year we've been spending some money that would qualify.
That's
therefore,
right.
That could go over there and be spent from those funds, which would offset some other general funds. But we haven't been spending this much money. We've only been spending like $7 million or something like that. So we're only going to, in school funding,
no,
only been about seven.
Our
unless you
debt
use the debt reimbursement as well. Then it offsets general fund. If you're
right.
Already using it to offset, but it isn't new revenue.
Well, I understand, but now you're kind of splitting hairs whether it's new revenues or isn't. But, you know, in my conversation, it was definitely viewed as, well, yes, if it was for school construction, et cetera, it could definitely replace some existing general fund revenues that we're currently spending.
Well, the reason I ask, because I ran into the same problem with CBR, my CBR, the leveraging agent, your earnings of it, and I ran into the same problem. Sorry, Tim, but we're already using those earnings to balance.
I understand. Yeah, I hear you. And that's true, that it is a replacement revenues for other things. It now allows us to reduce general fund spending, is what it does. It doesn't really provide, but it does do, in that respect, it does help to close the fiscal gap.
Oh, yeah.
Mike?
I've just taken a look at the latest version of the five-year plan that I have, and everything you said is a little bit right, but I think I need some clarification. There's a line in the plan talking about remaining new revenues, and I looked at the footnote for that, and that seems to be tied to development of additional or enhanced recovery on oil fields.
Right.
The impact of tobacco tax is indicated in a footnote number 2, where that would be the general fund portion of the cigarette tax is taken into account in the unrestricted revenue forecast. But I still haven't found that piece of that dedicated portion, the 32 or the 34 million annually, and I'm still looking for that. But I think, as was discussed, one way of looking at that too is right now we're putting in 60 some million a year of general fund into the school debt reimbursement program, and one thought was, for example, is replace that with the dedicated tobacco tax money, and then free up a like amount of general fund. And I'm trying to sort those discussions in my mind with what was actually put in the plan, and I'm just not certain of that. But I don't see anything in the footnotes that specifically addresses that, then other than the two things I mentioned in terms of the oil revenues for the new revenues and the general fund portion of the tobacco tax. I realize some of that goes to the general fund, but the lion's share of it is the
is the dedicated school tax portion.
Well, it does come back, I mean, you know, now you, the whole issue, they all are connected in the sense that you get back to your opening statement today, Mike, about $350 to $400 million gap. Well, if I look at this in the five-year plan, and it concerns me that you're not that familiar with it, in the sense that, you know, I mean, being with Ledge Finance, I'm only seeing total, if you look toward three-quarters way down the page, total required from CBRF appropriations, $260 million in FY99, $303 million in the FY2000, $258 million in the FY2001. Well, granted, when you're getting further out there, bigger guess, but FY99, we're drawing in on it or honing in on it. I don't see the $350 to $400 million gap that you do.
Where that, the $350 to $400 million comes from is taking strictly the amount that would come off the revenue projections of the unrestricted general fund using the spring forecast, and that'll be updated very soon with the fall numbers. Then compare those revenues against the current or last year's appropriated level less $50 million. There, as I mentioned earlier, there's other assumptions that you can make about other things that can balance the budget in addition to the CBR. For example, this last session we used some money from HSC, we used some money from ADA, we had some savings, we had some in effect a windfall from investment loss trust money. What the answer is, basically, as you get into these out years, they're all right because they're all guesses. It's you know, it's whose guess is better, yours, mine, or somebody else's. All you can really do, as I was trying to bring forth in these notes, is try to understand the assumptions that the various people are using when they're making these guesses. So I can say, well, did you take into account in yours that you would be getting a $50 million dividend from HFC or a $70 million dividend from HFC? Or when you talked about new revenues, did you talk just about more oil revenues, or were you talking about non-oil revenue sources? So there is no single answer. It's just like we need to understand what our assumptions are when we're throwing the numbers out there.
I understand. I mean, I understand that. I thought you understood the assumptions that were placed on the sheet. Representative Elman.
Well, just a thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a comment that I don't expect an answer to, but I think from what I understood from Mike that I'm comfortable with his answers. I mean, I hope that the cigarette tax money is not counted as new revenues in here because that would be artful. I mean, some people sold the cigarette tax not based on additional revenues to the general fund, but based on additional money to the school system. And so anybody that talks about substituting general fund dollars that are now going to the schools for construction or for maintenance and substituting cigarette tax money and freeing up other general fund dollars, we would deserve the criticism that we would get. I think we sold this based on those revenues being an increment to what
some of us sold it at. But I would also, I mean, as I look at this, Representative Elton, I stand to be corrected. I do not see it calculated in here. Only as Mike said, the general fund part. As I pull it apart too, I don't see the additional $30 to $40 million projected calculated in here. So I think they have left it out.
Well, I just like to respond to that since I was the one that started this thing. I know what I meant, and I know that we've been having about $7 million in general fund spending on school construction in the last couple of years, and that I felt this additional money would offset that $7 million plus add some. I never thought about the bond reimbursement part being applied from these funds, even though I knew that it would qualify. I thought of it about a $7 million assistance to general fund, and then the rest would be additional money spent on schools. That was my idea. But I'm only one, and I'm not the one that got it passed. I was the only one that put it forward, so that was my intent.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Sarah Cummings.
Could we get staff to investigate that and see if the projected number is through the tobacco tax? I'm pretty certain it does, simply because that projection was May 11th, which was after, I believe, we passed the tobacco tax, and I believe it was early, in earlier versions, it was a proposed revenue figure that would go in, and I think it has been rolled in there. Could you check that out?
We will check it out. Are there any further questions for Mike or Forrest? Forrest, thank you very much for taking the time and walking us through bonding 101.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Madam Speaker.
Sign off now. I've got to go and catch a plane, so I'll see you in the morning.
See you in the morning, Madam Speaker.
Thanks.
The next item on the agenda is Department of Transportation. And we do have, after that was the Department of Administration. They are not going to be here in person. They are, however, on teleconference. Please join us, Dennis. And Boyd. Department of Administration is on teleconference, and so we will attempt to take this time. I know that we are running a bit behind, but try to get to the point, utilizing the time between now and 4 o'clock to try and do both DOT and DOA.
Chair, thank you very much. My name is Boyd Brownfield. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. I have with me here Dennis Bouchard, who is Special Assistant to the Commissioner. He will be giving the briefing. I'll be giving him moral support. I must point out that I have an appointment at 3. I'm going to let him wait for about 15 or 20 minutes. If we're not done by then, I've just got to get up and leave.
Understood.
I apologize for that. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Dennis, and he can start our briefing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really appreciate the opportunity to meet with the task force today and just talk a little bit about transportation maintenance and funding for deferred maintenance. Since I'm relatively new to DOT, as many of you know, I wouldn't want to attempt this alone and kind of drug Bo along with me. I'll try to keep my remarks relatively quick so that we can get to questions before Bo has to leave. The presentation may seem overly simplistic, but it's intended to provoke questions regarding specifics. So I'll walk you through it really quickly. The purpose of the presentation is to address questions about federal funding of deferred maintenance projects and to talk about funding options for maintenance, including tax increases, fuel tax increases, and then also no discussion on fuel tax increases that would be intended to deal with deferred maintenance would be complete without a discussion of a dedicated fund. And then one other thing that might be considered is some sort of revenue sharing option for maintenance, too. I'm going to pretty much try to stick to talking about the federal funding question and the other funding options. A little bit of background, real quickly. With decline in funds for maintenance of roads, airfields, and harbors, the facilities are gradually deteriorating, and the state's going to start losing some valuable assets. Continued lack of adequate state-funded maintenance will directly affect the public's use of those facilities. And Department of Transportation and Public Facilities continues to work to increase efficiency. Most recently, we completed an internal effectiveness review process for dealing with the budget cuts. This resulted in a reduction of over 100 positions. Although we're continually becoming more efficient at providing the service we provide, we kind of feel as though we're about at the end of the line and that DOT is not likely going to be able to continue pulling a rabbit out of the hat as far as maintenance is concerned. And finally, Department of Transportation and Public Facilities lacks a stable and reliable funding source to maintain our transportation system. We are still operating with roughly the same maintenance budget as we were in 1983. Types of DOT maintenance, obviously we're responsible for highways, airports, public facilities, and harbors. I'll concentrate mostly on highways, airports, and harbors. I believe that other DOT staff have spoke with you before on the public facilities end of this. As far as the deferred maintenance backlog, how does it happen? Where did it come from, and why does it seem to continue to grow? As far as DOT is concerned, we have specific annual maintenance costs. Those maintenance costs can be divided into a couple of different categories. The first one would be health, safety, maintenance type category, the operational type things. Those types of things would be snow plowing, replacing lights, for example, when lights go out. In addition to replacing the lights, we've got to pay the light bill to the electric company to keep them on and running. And things like traffic signs. It's very important that we stay on top of those. Other types of maintenance, which are important for the long-term health of our transportation system, but seem to get pushed off to, you know, we do them as we can. Those are things like filling potholes, brush cutting, sealing the surfaces, and cleaning ditches. And those are items that are very important, obviously, to the long-term health of any road in particular. You know, if you don't fill the potholes on a regular basis, they continue to get worse until eventually you have to replace the entire surface. If you don't cut the brush, then the roots get into the base course and cause problems on the road surface. If you don't clean the ditches, the water tables rise and you get frost heaves. All of those things are things that we're responsible for doing. Although the things on the right of that picture are the things that get pushed off until after we've dealt with the more important things of snow plowing, maintaining lights, etc. So when the annual maintenance costs exceed the annual maintenance budget, the difference is obviously your annual backlog or your annual deferred maintenance backlog. That's what we keep adding. If you look at a three-year average, the most recent 3 years, you'd be talking about an annual maintenance budget of roughly $73 million. Estimated annual maintenance costs of identified maintenance of about $92.3 million. So our shortfall is about $19.5 million annually. Also, because of the budgeting cycle, if you have a particularly bad winter or something like that, snow plowing can take a majority of your money. And by the time spring comes along, dollars for overtime for the things like brush cutting and filling potholes, et cetera, are at a minimum. As far as revenues versus appropriations for highways and airports, if you look at the chart that we've prepared, you can see that what we take in terms of fuel taxes and et cetera, there is a big difference between what's appropriated. There's also, if you look at the chart, you can see that essentially if you look at it's got $1983 dollars adjusted out for the CPI. And if you look at those, we are funded about $40 million less than that $28.3 million, according to the FY96 figure in the chart, but the figure is probably closer to $40 million for FY98 from the 1983 level, once you adjust for inflation. The other thing that if you look at this chart, the increase is only adjusted for CPI. This does not take into account increases for things like new lights. If we add new lights to a particular stretch of road, then obviously our electric bill goes up and the maintenance costs for those lights, for our lights goes up. Adding things like overpasses for safety increases our maintenance costs. Taking roads from two-lane to four-lane to decrease congestion and increase traffic flow increase our maintenance costs, et cetera, et cetera. None of that is factored into that chart. If you go to the next page and you look at the revenues versus appropriations for ports and harbors, it's pretty easy to see that we've not had a steady stream. It's kind of a spiky picture. It goes up and down pretty regularly. Although the marine fuel tax that we take in as a state is significantly higher than the appropriation that we put towards our ports and harbors. If you look at, to specifically address the question of using federal funds for deferred maintenance, the question is, can we use federal funds for deferred maintenance? And the answer essentially is yes. And to a certain degree, the department already is doing that. This past year, or this year in our FY98 budget, we have $14 million allocated towards the deferred maintenance backlog by line item in the STIF. It was about $14 million. And that's up from approximately $300,000 in the early 90s. And we continually work with the FHWA every year to increase that line item in our capital improvement program. In addition, our annual rehabilitation reconstruction program reduces that backlog by a small percentage. And I'll talk more about that in just a second. As far as whether or not we can increase that, we will continue to increase it minimally, but we can't just suddenly decide to spend $100 million, for example, on federal money on deferred maintenance backlog without very serious negative effects on our annual reconstruction and rehabilitation program. Every dollar that's taken away from that program for maintenance reduces our construction budget for paving gravel roads, for upgrading our national highway system, and other things that the Federal Highway Administration, and as well as the legislature and the administration, put a premium on. In addition to that, I guess,
I asked the basic question on can we use federal funds for deferred maintenance. Now, as I understand it, talking to some of the staff at DAPA, there has been some change in what the parameters are on that. And perhaps it would be useful if just very, very quickly, and I understand the problem of if you take money, Gerard Peter to pay Paul, somebody's still short money, I understand. But if you could very briefly share with us what kind of options have been opened up as opposed to originally it was all basically you build new, which has been one of the driving problems that you don't want to repair something because you get money to replace it but not keep it up. Can you just give us a little bit on that flexibility?
Through the chair, let me try to answer that if I may, sir. Back in 19, the ICE-T funding is what we're talking about, in 1991 is when it first came out. At that time, the rules and regulations on federal highway funds was you cannot use them for any maintenance at all, zero maintenance. That year, we started work on the FHWA and said, look, we need to have something. They gave us, in 1991, about $100,000. I'm talking about Central Region because at the time I was in the design and construction, and later on the maintenance operation of the Central Region. We were able to get them the next year to give us about $300,000. You know, and this was great because $300, this is when we started crack seeding. This is when, some of you recall, we put teams together so they could, we took different stations put teams together so they could start track seeding various areas. At that time, they said you can do this, but you can only use it on the national highway system, because the FHWA, the primary purpose of that funding is for the national highway system. We continue to work with these folks on what we can do and what we can't do. Throughout ICT, we're able to make, just move forward a little bit more, $100,000 to $300,000 a year. This year, we've been able to put a lot more on there, because they finally said, you can use your funding not only on national highway system, but you can also use it on all public roads. And when you use that, it must be used in such a way that it extends the life of that pavement. That does not include snow removal, does not include potholes, does include to a certain extent sealing your pavement, because that will add life to the pavement. But they opened a large door there. When they did that, and in connection with a dire need for us to make many of our gravel roads paved roads, because that's a tremendous expense on our system, we are now putting in as line items in our STIP chunks of $2.5 million for Central Region, so that they can take that amount of money based on their priorities, put that on some of our gravel roads to get them paved roads. We now this year have $14 million that they've approved in our STIP, so we can put that on those types of items that we can pave roads that are gravel, and do a heck of a lot more with our FHWA money toward significant maintenance and operation costs that will restore the life and extend the life of our pavements. We now have no federal funding whatsoever. Right now, ICT is finished. It was finished last, I think, at the beginning of September. We don't have Next T, I think is what they called it. Now they came to Best T, and they're still wrestling with that in the Congress. Not really sure what we're going to come up with. But right now, as we stand, we have no federal funding, except what we think is going to happen is they're going to pass a six-month allocation to keep us moving. We hope that the next, whatever ICT is going to be, that we're going to get a lot more lenience toward what we can use that money for. But we have to be very careful, because certainly they're not going to allow us to pick up ICT funds and say, that's it, I'm going to take my $229 million deficit on my highways and aviation and use it all toward that. They would not allow us to do that. We still have to have a very, very prominent national highway system, and our national highways are in need of operation of the highways we already have. We maximize that every year. What Dennis was trying to tell you is even maximizing that, we're going behind every year, $19 million a year, on the average, on a three-year average. Every year that passes by, we have $19 million in deferred maintenance. The next year that goes, depending on what we do, which is less than what we're able to do, that's a cumulative every year. We're now at about $229 million in a deficit on our highways and aviation. I hope I answered your question, maybe a little bit more than that, but we've evolved from the point where they would say no, nothing at all, to the point now where they are allowing a significant amount of our funds to go toward maintenance and repair.
Representative James.
A quick question. On the $229 million deficit you have on highways and aviation, are you using any calculations for paving of airports?
No, ma'am. This is 227 does include airports.
Yes, it does.
But not, does it include paving as opposed to?
No, ma'am, it does not. That's a good point. Okay. We have something like 83 of our 266 airports that are gravel. I'm sorry, 181.
But ICT funding, that's a six-year program.
Yes, ma'am. It usually is a six-year program. That does not have to be that way. It could be a one-year program, depending on what Congress wants it to be. It could be a two-year program. Historically, it's been about a six-year program. We hope they keep it that way, at least for this particular next team, I guess we call it.
Okay.
I'll continue on now. I guess I'd also, I did mention that our reconstruction program also reduces backlog to some degree. And I'll try to go into that a little bit more. Many of the projects that we designate on the STIP or on the CTP or the NHS system are also on the deferred maintenance list. And I'd like to try and explain a little bit about the reconstruction versus deferred maintenance and what the difference is. As far as the reconstruction and the deferred maintenance, they don't match up dollar for dollar. I'd like to use East End Road, for example. If you look at that project, it's down near Homer. It's approximately $400,000 is what it's listed at if you find it on the deferred maintenance list. Although we're getting ready to go in this next summer and do a major reconstruction, and that's going to cost $5 million. Now, the difference being, in deferred maintenance, all we've identified for deferred maintenance is just resurfacing what's there. And as far as reconstruction, we're going to go in, we're going to put a new alignment on the road, straighten out dangerous curves, we're going to put in new guardrails that are needed, we're going to completely resurface the road and reconstruct the entire road. And there's a big difference. So if you see a project on the in the STIP or on the capital, the CTP or the NHS, that and it's listed at $5 million or $14 million or whatever, that doesn't necessarily correspond to a reduction of that amount of money on the deferred maintenance list. And I think that's an important distinction to make. But you should know that our reconstruction program, we do identify roads that are on the deferred maintenance list, and generally because of being in such a state of disrepair, they have a way of working their way up and being funded, and they can be taken off the deferred maintenance list as we do them. I guess that's pretty much the federal funding question. I'd like to now switch gears and talk about the other side of the equation.
Before you go on to, how much have we authorized in federal funds? How much the legislature actually authorized?
To date, we have nothing authorized.
No.
But for the last 6 years, what has it been
about? Have many things that we have authorized funds we've spent on that are in the STIP for the future, that are not even in the STIP. We've authorized millions upon millions of federal dollars in our budgets. We authorize them, but you have to spend them. How much money, back authorization, do you have to spend for money?
I don't know that figure offhand. I do know that we have spent the last two or three years trying to whittle what we call old authority down. I think you all brought this up several years ago. The first year, in working with our regions, we were able to reduce it by about $150 to $200 million of just authorization. It's not money sitting anywhere. It's the authorization to spend money, most of which has already been spent. For instance, if you have a project and you leave it open and that project has $30,000 on it, we've left these things open for years, back in the 70s. We're trying to close those up now. We had a huge push toward that. As I said before, we've eliminated about $150 to $200 million worth, and we still have a ways to go. But I don't know.
I think you have quite a ways to go. It'd be interesting how much we've authorized them to spend that they don't even spend. And in fact, I know projects that aren't even on the STIP that we've been authorized for a number of years. And I guess this is part of this whole thing. Sometimes we pass something and we think something's getting done, and 5 years later, hasn't been a penny spent on that, even though 5 years ago we authorized them to do so. So I think I'm as frustrated we get $200+ million a year from the federal government, and we seem to pass things to get them done, but yet sometimes they never get done. Excuse me, I wonder.
Um,
See if you had an answer.
If I might, on that point,
just one quickly, give me one or two or three reasons why that happened.
I'm not sure we're going to get anywhere going there, because I think we're obvious, and I've never seen limited debate before, but, you know, excess authorization is a whole other area outside of deferred maintenance.
Well, I think I kind of know the answer, just because we authorize it doesn't necessarily mean we're going to get the money.
Through the chair, that's correct, to be very honest, we have to renew STIPS every year. We've got to go out to the public, ask them what their needs are, and that does not necessarily mean that's going to get on the STIP, but we ask what needs are, and that's unrestrained. We get billions of dollars worth of needs out there. Every time you go to a different area, they come back. And then we have to decipher what is the most needed of those, and this administration has come up with a very elaborate way to grade those, if you will, to come up with what are the biggest, most important needs of the state of Alaska. We didn't do that in the past. What we did in the past is we gave a certain amount of money to each of the regions, said go to it, and they got what they felt was necessary to build. We don't think that we're going to get this $220 or $230 million a year forever. In fact, we're pretty sure that if we get this next T, whatever they call it, for the next 6 years, we're going to be pretty lucky, because the state of Alaska has enjoyed a real good position of getting a fairly favorable amount of money from the federal government for years and years and years. Now people are starting to ask us, well, wait a minute, state of Alaska. And I've been down low for you when they say, aren't you the guy that gets $1,000 a month? Well, yeah, that's us. Don't you have a $20 billion rainy day program? Yes, sir, we sure do. Then why are you asking for money? Because, in fact, by your population and by your roads, you should get far less than what you're getting. We get, for every dollar we put in, we get six, in some cases, $7 back. That's the highest in the nation. If we were to get one-to-one, the federal government would give us about $30 million. That comes from $220 down to $30 million. So we feel that we've got to take this 200, 220, 195, whatever it is each year, and apply it to where we feel it's going to do the most good. We projected that over maybe 10 years if we continue to get it for 10 years. And that's what we based our program on. Now, when you do that, a lot of the projects that were in the system way back when we had a lot of money and we had a lot of state money, because back in the early 80s we did have a lot of state financing. A lot of these projects that are approved in concept and that we're given approval to spend monies, which is what you're referring to, sir, were never built. In fact, there are cases where we have a project that we put in fully intending to do that, but as times change and priorities change, these projects are very, very big, they're very expensive, and they fall to the wayside. FHWA holds our feet to the fire also, because if we start the process of financing a particular project up to a certain point, beyond what we call our environmental assessment of it, after that point, if we don't build it in 10 years, they make us pay the money back. And there are several occasions when we do have projects right now that are in being that a time limit is coming very close to us. We've got to make decisions on what we do. And we haven't worked on those projects for a long time.
Representative Mathis, did you?
I'll just write or call the commissioner on this.
Thank you.
Because it does have to do with deferred maintenance, so I'll add him.
Cutting to the chase, the next couple of pages are really easily summarized.
Yeah.
You know, tack on a penny gallon and get you $8 million. Now, how price sensitive is that when it comes to jet fuel?
Well, you can look at the comparison to other states, I guess, as a gauge for how we are in terms of jet fuel taxes and aviation gas taxes. And if you look at, I have a couple of slides on that, the Alaska ranks 17th out of 50 in jet fuel at 3.2 cents a gallon, and the U.S. median's at 3.5 cents a gallon. So we're real near the median. If you look at aviation gas, we're at 4.7 cents a gallon. We rank 28th, and the median is 5.2. So we're near the median on aviation fuel tax rates. If you look at highway tax rates, gasoline tax rates, Alaska ranks 50th out of 50 in gas taxes. We have a per gallon total of 8 cents of state taxes. The national median is 22.5 cents per gallon. So we're less than, actually about a third of the national median as far as our gas tax.
As a matter of fact, we're the lowest. We're 50 out of 50 states on the gas tax.
Right. I guess my point, I mean, everybody understands that we're far behind. But when it gets to, I mean, and everybody can understand the conflicts that we've had in relation to dedicating motor fuel and that. When it comes across, though, as you look at the penny a gallon model, creating $8 million annually revenue, there reaches a point where if you raise your aviation fuel too high, that tax, or jet fuel tax, people can get the fuel from somewhere else, especially the jets. Do you know where that price sensitivity is? Where you go before they start going other places?
Representative Mulder, that's a question I really can't answer. I haven't done any study into the elasticity of the aviation fuel tax. You might, or I could check with the Income and Excise Audit Division for you. I know that they've done a fair amount of research on that topic.
I think also we could get an answer for you, Representative Mullen, if you need that. Yeah. We can get that from our international airport system.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but it just seems the next is a pretty evident number that we all know. We're one of the lowest tax states when it comes to fuel tax, and that we're one of only two states that don't have a dedicated tax.
And an important issue, too, is that we just took over, as an example, took over the weights and measures that you all know that, and we're trying desperately to find good ways to finance, better finance that operation because it's vital to our highways. They're barely on the edge. We can find ways to do that. For instance, we charge trucks when they come into the state of Alaska nothing. And people generally charge $200, $300, $400, and the truckers expect that when they go from one state to the other. When we say it costs you $5 to come to Alaska, they laugh. They can't believe it. But that's what we pay. We could get good financing that way. But getting the financing is just the first step because and I might be talking out of the box here, but when you get that financing, it goes back in general funds, it doesn't go to where it's needed. The dedicated or some mechanism that gets it back into the place that it's needed the most is very important. Without that one, the first step doesn't really do as much good.
How much do we spend annually on maintenance for airports, ports, and roads?
For airports, ports, and roads, total, we spend
227 plus 35.
Well, annually. We spend about, let's see, if you include the marine highways also, about...
Do we have to?
Yeah.
Where's that at?
Roughly 130 million or so.
Okay, and how much do we take in annually from fuel taxes?
Let's look that up for you. We take in approximately, let's see, 37.7 million.
So we're spending $100 million more annually than what we're even taking in fuel tax.
Close to. In my round added figures from my head, yes.
So then that's been Representative James' contention all along. We could tax ourselves through the moon, we would never reach that point where we're self-sustaining and not relying on the general fund in relation to fuel tax.
Our last conclusion when we were talking about dedicated tax on the highways was that by raising the fuel from 8 cents to say 21 cents, which is the national average, that would only augment our general funds. It would not replace it. Originally, we thought it would replace it, but it would not. You're absolutely correct.
Representative Kabina.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that's one thing the public I think they would be supportive of raising the tax so many cents if they thought that money was going over and above what we were doing to fix our roads. But just to go and say, okay, here we're going to raise it, and then nothing changes, I think that's when we get everybody mad at us out there.
I agree. I was just trying to dispel the notion that we could, in fact, totally take over the maintenance function of the general fund portion by instituting taxes. Just the numbers just aren't there.
But on that point is our price at the pump is already too high. That's the problem. We ought to find another source of revenue to go in there, I believe. I got some ideas I'll share with you later.
Are there further questions? Trying to get Boyd to make certain that he's able to rep. Senator Lee Lehman.
What is marine off-highway fuel tax? There's $29,000 there. I'm not connecting.
Jet.
That's
marine
off-highway. Well, there's a category for marine, and there's one marine off-highway.
I'll let my business
and tax boats.
If you can, if you don't
there, there is an exemption for off-highway usage. How that works out in terms of marine fuel, I guess I'm not certain.
I'm aware of the off-highway exemption for highway, but I'm not sure what the marine off-highway is.
I'm not either.
Yeah. Sometime, if you can find that.
Other than the marine highway usage.
Yeah, I can give you a figure for how much it is. I just don't know
what it is.
What
it's a small amount.
Right.
And
are there further questions for Dennis or Boyd? Now, we really appreciate you coming here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Terry Kelly.
I'll contact you.
Library and University of Alaska facilities construction, 5743, not bad. I mean, you know, that's 20,000 vote difference for 150,000 votes in 1980. You should probably look at education tied to the University of Alaska. It's probably having a pretty good margin. Water supply and sewage systems, 5644, pretty good spread there.
I'm not sure. What were those bond issues on?
This one was 33,000 for water supply. Transportation was 157 million. That was million, 33 million. Education was 64 million. You know, but then people. I mean, this is in 1980. People's perceptions are bigger these days. That was, for those days, that was a lot of money. But you better stay away from correctional facilities. It passed by 2%, and then in 1978, public safety facilities passed by 0.5%. That's a real close call. And you got a real loser if you're looking at cultural facilities, 4554. Facilities upgrade construction, it sounds a lot like the first movement. 4456. You better stay away from New State Capitol. $966 million effort lost $26.74. But water supply and sewage is pretty safe out there. Fish facilities, the
probably didn't pass both in 78 and 80 at about 56.44. So I don't know, just food for thought, that you're talking transportation, you're probably on good safe ground, you're talking education versus asset, good safe ground. We're talking prisons and some of these other things, and it's getting weaker out there.
That's
why I just thought I'd throw that out. We will get this information to you so you can look at it.
Well, that certainly is heartening to me, Senator Kelly.
Now you see why you had such a problem in the legislature.
Those numbers correlate in the legislature, too, I might add. The next folks that we have online with us, like I said, they're on teleconference from the Department Administration, relates to rent structure for maintenance with Division of Administrative Services. I know that we have Alice and Algie online, and Rod Wilson, and I also believe we have Mr. Kreinheider online also. Jack. Are you there, Allison, Rod, and Jack?
Yes, we are, Mr. Chairman. This is Allison Elgie, and you've identified the participants correctly.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Okay, thank you. Approximately a year and a half ago, the administration put together an interdepartmental working group that was made up of the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, the Office of Management and Budget, and the Department of Administration, to look specifically at the issues surrounding the maintenance and operations of the state's buildings. In addition to that steering committee, we invited the participation of all departments in a facilities advisory group to look at various issues surrounding state facility occupancy. And one of the recommendations from that facilities advisory group was that we pursue the possibility of developing a rent structure for state facilities, primarily state office buildings and state warehouse facilities. The reasons that the group recommended that was because with a rent structure, we felt that a more stable funding environment would be created for the maintenance of state facilities that would allow us to avoid the continued development of a deferred maintenance backlog. Now, just to be clear, the rent structure itself would not clear up the deferred maintenance that currently exists, but would be a mechanism to avoid future deferred maintenance. Also, rent structure would allow us to recover some of the operating and maintenance costs of facilities from federal and other non-general fund sources by distributing those costs across all programs that occupy state office buildings and charging the respective fund sources, and would create an incentive for more efficient use of space, because once people have to pay for the space, we believe more thought will go into just exactly how much space programs actually need. Also, we've looked at the possibility of establishing an internal service fund, which would require legislation, but an internal service fund used in conjunction with the rent structure would allow us to accrue funds for the renewal and replacement projects, which we often refer to as major maintenance, the replacement of major building components like roofs and HVAC systems. This rent structure approach is one that is very similar to approaches that are used in a variety of other states. What we discovered in looking at this rent structure approach is that there are several things that we do not know about current operations of state government. First of all, we discovered that we don't know what we're presently spending. And to address that, we have worked to develop a standardized accounting practice using the state's accounting system for all departments to record their expenditures for state facility operations and maintenance, and that became effective the 1st of July of this fiscal year. So from this point on, we should be gathering information in a consistent fashion throughout our various departments. We also recognize that we have very sketchy information on who's occupying exactly how many square feet in various facilities, and even less information when you get down to a program level, which we will need in order to be able to appropriately distribute costs by program. And then we recognized that we needed to do some research to determine just exactly what we needed to be spending on an annual basis in order to cover all of those elements of rent to fully fund the operations of our state facilities. When you look at those elements of rent, the rent should be made up of several things. First of all, you need to look at the operating costs of the facility itself, and that includes the utilities, the janitorial, the day-to-day kinds of occupancy costs, the routine and preventative maintenance of the facility that needs to go on regularly in order not to have the building falling down, the administration of the program, and again, the renewal and replacement costs of the major building components, which don't come up annually, but come up as those building components wear out. In order to pursue this rent structure development, we contracted with David Griffith and Associates. This is the group that does our internal cost allocation strategy for the state. And they have worked with us to look at other states' programs and to identify just exactly how we could put together a rent structure that would be acceptable to the federal government. For instance, the federal government will not allow us to include in a rent structure a component piece that's specific to renewal and replacement. But what they will allow is a piece that represents depreciation on our buildings that we can then use to fund renewal and replacement. We are going this year to develop a rent structure pilot. We'll be starting with the state office building here in Juneau, and it will be primarily a paper rent structure, but we're going to work to identify who's occupying what pieces of the building, look at a developing a rent structure on a trial basis to see how that works, and do a paper billing to various programs in the state office building so that they'll get used to what it might cost under a rent structure. And we will be expanding that to other state-owned facilities, just trying to complete one building at a time, so that we would be in a position, if people so chose, to include an actual rent structure proposal in the development of our fiscal year 2000 budget proposal, which we would be developing this time next year. The other piece, and I mentioned this earlier, that we would also be looking at would be legislation to create an internal service fund, and we would like to begin working on that legislation this upcoming session. The major challenge we know with putting a rent structure in place is going to be funding. Our current spending we know is too low, which has resulted in the deferred maintenance backlog, which you've had identified for you for state facilities. And we think that probably the best way to handle that would be a phased-in approach in terms of implementing a rent structure throughout government. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my overview, and the three of us are here to respond to questions. If you have questions of any of us, please feel free to ask.
Thank you. This is Representative James Allison. My question to you, in your consideration of this internal service fund and all of the other parts of this rent structure, had you considered at all having a centralized place besides this? Because I understand this internal service fund is only for that amount of money that you'd be setting up on the life cycle program for replacement and renewal. What about the ongoing preventative maintenance and so forth? Had you considered having that under one head leadership for the state?
Through the chair, Representative James, yes, we would use an internal service fund to collect all rents, all the pieces of the rent, and then we would fund the various operations and maintenance and administration kind of costs from that internal service fund, and only accrue on a year-to-year basis the piece that represents the renewal and replacement costs. We would have an annual renewal and replacement budget that would come along with whatever proposal we put before the legislature each year, but the accrual of the component of rent that represented that renewal and replacement would occur over a number of years. So we're looking at all of the pieces of rent running through that internal service fund. We've also had some discussion about consolidating the maintenance and operations functions for facilities. As you know, the right now it's split pretty much between the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities and the Department of Administration. The Department of Administration is managing all leased facilities, where the Department of Transportation is managing state-owned facilities. We're not prepared to move on that this year, but it's something that is on the table that we continue to actively discuss and see some real merit in continuing to pursue that concept as well.
I had somewhat of the same question on that internal service fund. When you say you collect all the rent and then fund the operation or maintenance out of that fund, does that go, as you collect it, does it go back to that community or that facility for upgrade, or is that a pot thing someone decides where the most needs are?
Through the chair, Senator Lincoln, the rent structure we've discovered needs to be developed specific to the various facilities. You can put together kind of area rents for facilities all in a close campus kind of environment. But the rent for facilities in Anchorage will be different than facilities in Fairbanks, which will be different than facilities in Nenana. What we would end up with is a rent structure that really represents the cost of operating and maintaining those specific facilities for which we're collecting rent. Now, so the bills would be being paid for those specific facilities. The renewal and replacement costs are accrued over a number of years, and there would be a prioritization of renewal and replacement projects that would be recommended to the legislature each year with funding from the Internal Service Fund.
Gary? Allison, this is Gary Wilkins. I'm interested to know just how novel this concept is. Is there another government or entity somewhere that's doing what you're proposing? How much new ground are we plowing here?
Yeah. Thank you, Senator Wilkins. No, this is not novel at all. We have already done quite a bit of research in identifying approaches that other states use, and our contractor with David Griffith and Associates has worked with a number of states in developing rent structures that have been approved by the federal government. Anything we develop would have to be approved by the Federal Office of Management and Budget. Rod Wilson has done quite a bit of that research. I'm sure you can expand on that if you would like to know more detail.
Not right now, thank you. Just so we're not leading the pack here, there are other states that are out there, have done it before.
Oh, yes, a number of states have had this in place for quite a few years.
Thank you.
Jim?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Allison, I'm curious as to whether or not you envision at the end of this assessment, and if you envision a plan that centralizes the assessment of the rental rates, the collection of the facilities funds, or whether you see, for example, corrections doing their own for correctional facilities, public health doing their own, health and social services doing their own for public health facilities, or do you see kind of a recreation of a system like the old Department of Public Facilities?
Through the chair, Representative Elton, this has been the topic of quite a bit of discussion with the Facility Advisory Committee. Initially, what the recommendation has been is that we look at the multi-use facilities, and that's why we've been concentrating on office buildings and on warehouses, so that the facilities like correctional facilities and the facilities that are serving the program needs of just one particular department would continue to be managed and maintained by those specific departments. There's no reason in the future that that couldn't be changed, or that the internal service fund could not be used by those departments while still maintaining that separate administration.
Thanks, Ellison.
Any other questions? Ellison, anything else?
I don't think we have anything more at this end.
Okay, so there's nothing more from Juneau? Denny, do you have a question?
Yes, I have one question. Allison, on buildings where we are leasing and paying lease payments to private owners, how do you handle that rent, and is that a problem with the federal government?
Through the chair, Representative James, we would look at consolidating the leasing payment management with the rent collection of the facilities that we own as a state. The only caveat that we would have in terms of administering that that would be different than the collection of rent is that we cannot pool lease costs in a campus basis. We have to charge back the rent to the programs exactly as we're being charged for lease space.
Well, if I might, are you doing that now?
To the degree that we can identify leased space as being occupied by programs primarily funded from other sources, we collect funds directly from those programs. And in our leasing budget, you'll see several million dollars identified as interagency receipts. Those are the monies that are coming from programs that are funded in large part by the federal government that are occupying lease space.
I just want to make one comment on that because of my frustration over the last 4 years to try to pass some legislation which would do principally what you're talking about doing, that my alternative was to sell and lease back, and then we wouldn't have a problem.
Allison, I think we have one more question from Denny.
Representative Elton really got to the question I had, but I did have maybe a second one that might be helpful. One of the questions that has been asked by various members of the task force, is there a number that we need to put aside for deferred maintenance? I gave you a handout that was prepared in 1995, I believe. But Rod Wilson shared a couple of numbers with me in terms of what some other states are doing. It might be helpful, I think, if you would just share those numbers with us very quickly.
Through the chair to Denny DeWitt. This is Rod Wilson. I did share with Dennis some of the information that I gathered from the states of Oregon and Idaho. And just as a matter of information only, the state of Oregon currently charges in the neighborhood of about $1.03 per square foot, and the state of Idaho is slightly over a dollar, somewhere between $1.05 and $1.10 per square foot. These are their rental costs. They are an all-inclusive rental cost in that they do include the recapture of the renewal and replacement, which is one of the things that typically leads to the backlog of deferred maintenance, is the absence of collecting for renewal and replacement. in comparison, and I can only speak for the DOT budget because that's the only one that I'm familiar with, but within the DOT budget, that same dollar thereabouts that we see in Idaho and Oregon is being capitalized right now within our budget at 49 cents per square foot. Now, I don't mean to suggest that we need to double those rates, but I do want you to realize that it is considerably less than what we are seeing in some of our sister states.
Thank you.
All right, are there any further questions for Allison or Rod or Jack? If not, thank you very much for participating with us today and appreciate, I know it was, you put together the presentation relatively quickly and I really appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The next person we have up is Bob Laresh.
I am Bob Laresh. I'm here representing some of my own ideas and also John Devine and Company. We're investment bankers in Cominco, Alaska. Their interest I will explain as we go on. You know, many years ago I was at a fundraiser for Jay Hammond in New York and Lowell Thomas Sr. was speaking. And he said, the problem with getting old is everything you hear reminds you of something else. I thought that was quaint at the time, but I've been getting to understand it. Senator Wilkin, I might tell you that in the 70s, we always had a large rent line in our operating budgets in the various departments. That was when Ash used to own the state buildings. So this is nothing new at all. Although if they do recapture R&R, Renewal and Replacement Funds, it would be a little bit new. But the principle has happened in this state for a long time before we got rich. So. Now, being a poor country investment banker, I don't have access to this colored clip art that my friend Forrest Brown does. But I have put together an outline of the points I'm going to make. And a few charts for your review after I finish, if you prefer. I also included, Denny suggested that I might give my own version of Bonding 101. I don't think that's necessarily necessary right now. Forrest did a really good job, I think. However, if you turn to the last part of this packet, which is entitled...
What's the front page title, please?
Financing, Alaska Deferred Maintenance Capital Construction. Okay.
Here's the front page, and this is the last part. It's municipal bond basics and common terminology. Let me make just a few points from a little different perspective than Forrest did. Maybe answer a couple of your questions in my own way that you did have for Forrest. On page four, there's a brief discussion of interest rates and the yield curve. In your discussions with Forrest, I don't think it was abundantly clear that interest rates don't depend on more than simply the credit rating and the maturity of the longest bond. And in fact, they depend on the GO bond, they depend in some measure on the credit, I mean in a large measure on the credit rating of the entity. In a revenue or a state-supported bond, they depend very little on that, but mostly on the structure of the bond and the credit that's offered for that specific bond. So they're not totally chained to the state's credit rating to any degree at all. Of course, they depend on the interest rate market from day to day, which you all understand implicitly. And finally, they do depend on maturity, but according to to a yield curve. That is, shorter bonds, one-year bonds, pay less interest than five-year bonds, which pay less interest than 10-year bonds. But the important thing I want to add, and there's a schedule on the last page here to illustrate this, is that every bond issue, I mean, if we do a 15-year bond for something, it would include several series bonds, probably from 1 to 10 years. You'd have some 1-year bonds, some 2-year bonds, some 3-year bonds, some 4-year bonds, paying progressively higher interest rates. Then you'd have a couple term bonds. They'd be 10s, 15s, probably. So the interest rate is really the weighted average of all those increasing interest rates. So you can structure these bonds to raise